In the last week of January, 1547, King Henry VIII lay dying in his palace at Whitehall. Once described as the handsomest prince in Christendom, he was now a swollen, rotting hulk, suffering terrible pain from the great ulcer on his leg. But his mind remained clear, and as long as he could speak, he bent all his energies on trying to safeguard the minority of his 9-year-old son, Edward. It was less than 70 years since the little princess had disappeared in the tower, and Henry had no illusions about the dangers that might lie ahead. He'd appointed a council to rule the country until Edward came of age. All the members were to have equal precedence, for there was no one man whom Henry would trust with supreme power. But already a plot was hatching to set aside these carefully devised precautions. Edward Seymour, Earl of Hertford, the young prince's uncle, saw himself as the obvious choice for regent. He found an ally in Sir William Paget, Chief Secretary of State. And during the last hours of the king's life, they paced the long gallery outside his bedchamber, laying their plans in discreetly lowered voices. Henry died at 2 o'clock in the morning on Friday, January the 28th. And barely 24 hours later, Hertford was writing to Paget.
This morning, between 1 and 2, I received your letter. The first part I like very well, marry, that the will should be opened, and that it might be well considered how much thereof were necessary to be published. For divers respects, I think it not convenient to satisfy the world. In the meantime, I think it sufficient, when ye publish the king's death, to have the will presently with you, and to show that this is the will, naming unto them severally who be executors that the king did specially trust, and who be counsellors. The contents shall be declared unto them on Wednesday in the morning at the Parliament House, and in the meantime we to meet and agree therein, as there may be no controversy hereafter. And so I bid you heartily farewell, the 29th of January, between 3 and 4 in the morning.
The official announcement of Henry's death was not made until the 31st, by which time Hertford had got possession of the little king and was bringing him to London. Paget had also approached the executors of the will and without much difficulty persuaded them to agree to a major reversal of its provisions.
Considering the greatness of the charge, the multitude of business, the number of executors appointed with like and equal charge, it should be more than necessary, as well for the honour, surety and good government of the king, our sovereign lord that now is, as for the more certain and assured direction of his affairs, that some special man of our number should be preferred before any other. We, therefore, by our whole consent and agreement, upon mature consideration of the tenderness and proximity of blood between King Edward, our sovereign lord that now is, and the Earl of Hertford, have given the chief place among us unto the Earl of Hertford, and also the name and title of Protector of all the realms and dominions of the King's Majesty, and appointed him to be Governor of the King's Most Royal Person.
Hertford, now created Duke of Somerset, was an idealist, a believer in liberty, progress, and reform, and ambitious, he was convinced, only for the best of reasons. His younger brother Thomas Seymour was a very different kind of man. Fierce in courage, courtly in fashion, in personage stately, in voice magnificent, but somewhat empty of matter. In the general sharing out of honours after King Henry's death, Thomas was given the title of Baron Seymour of Sudley and the office of Lord High Admiral. But he was far from satisfied. He was the king's uncle too, and had given good service to the country in the French wars, and on diplomatic missions abroad. Why should he now be excluded from any voice in the government? The new Lord Admiral felt an acute sense of grievance and lost no time in considering ways of improving his position. His first act was to look for a wife whose status would advance his own, and he presently renewed his courtship of Catherine Parr, King Henry's widow and Queen Dowager. Catherine had been in love with Tom Seymour when Henry had intervened to make her his sixth wife, and Tom felt certain that her feelings had not changed. He wrote to her in May.
If I knew by what means I might gratify your highness for your goodness to me, showed at our last being together, I should not be slack to declare mine own goodwill to you again. And to the intent that I will be more bound unto you, I do make my request, if it be not painful to you, that once in 3 days I may receive 3 lines and a letter from you, and as many lines and letters more as shall seem good unto you. And thus, for fear of troubling you, I take my leave of your highness, wishing that my hap may be once so good that I may declare so much by mouth at the same hour that this was written, being 12 of the clock at night, this Tuesday, the 17th of May, at St. James's.
Catherine was now 34. Attractive, intelligent, and sweet-natured, she'd already been obliged to nurse 3 elderly husbands. At long last, she was free to follow her own choice, and she allowed herself to be persuaded into a secret marriage, which took place sometime early that summer. The next step was to find a tactful way of making it public, and Catherine wrote to Tom from the Royal Manor of Chelsea.
As I gather from your letter, you are in some fear how to frame my lord or brother to speak in your favour to the council. I would not wish you to importune for his goodwill, if it come not frankly at the first. I would desire you might obtain the king's letters in your favour, and also the furtherance of the most notable of the council, as you shall think convenient. When it shall be your pleasure to repair hither, you must take some pains to come early in the morning, that you may be gone again by 7 o'clock. And so I suppose you may come without suspicion. I pray you, let me have knowledge overnight at what hour you will come, that your portress may wait for you in the fields. By her that is, and shall be, your humble, true, and loving wife.
The Admiral had already taken the precaution of bribing John Fowler, a member of the King's household, to carry messages, letters, and gifts of pocket money to his nephew. And he now asked Fowler to broach the subject of his marriage to Edward. Whether as a result of Fowler's good offices or not, the little king was graciously pleased to approve. But when the news finally leaked out, Edward noted laconically in his journal, "My Lord Protector was much displeased." By midsummer, Tom and Catherine were living openly together at Chelsea, and with them was King Henry's younger daughter, the Princess Elizabeth, who would be 14 that September. Elizabeth had been placed in the Queen's care after her father's death, and the council, rather surprisingly, allowed her to remain after Catherine's indiscreet marriage became known. It was at this time that Tom Seymour began to make a habit of paying early morning visits to the Princess, often before she was up or dressed. In his nightgown and slippers, he would come bursting into her bedroom to tickle her if she was still in bed, or play hide-and-seek with her and her maids amid much giggling and squealing. Elizabeth's governess, Catherine Ashley, regarded these romps with disapproval and attempted to remonstrate with the Admiral.
"My lord, it is not seemly that you should come to my lady's bedchamber while she is still abed. These things are complained of, and my lady will be evilly spoken of."
"God's precious soul, woman, there's no harm in it. These things complained of, forsooth. It is I who will complain to my lord, my brother, how I am slandered."
"But, my lord, it is an unseemly sight for you to come so bare-legged to a maiden's chamber. I fear the Queen's grace will be displeased, and I shall be blamed for permitting such doings."
"The Lady Elizabeth is like a daughter to me, and to the Queen. Nay, by God's soul, I'll not leave it, for I mean no evil."
"But, my lord, I have heard it said that your lordship would have married my Lady Elizabeth before you were married to the Queen."
"Nay, not I. Such a wife would cost me my life. It has been spoken of, but it could never be."
The Admiral continued to pay his morning visits, but it was noticed that Catherine now often came with him. He also continued to develop his plans for his own advancement and his brother's discomfiture. During the Protector's absence on a punitive expedition to Scotland, he contrived a private audience with the King, who had certain grievances of his own.
"My uncle of Somerset deals very hardly with me, and keeps me so straight that I cannot have money at my will.
Your Grace is a very beggarly king if you have no money for play or to give your servants. But you may have as much as you need from me through Master Fowler.
Master Stanhope has money for me, my lord. But I thank you, and I will remember.
Your Grace is too bashful in your own matters. You must take it upon yourself to rule, for you are able enough as other kings. Then you may give your men somewhat. My lord, my brother is old, and I trust will not live long.
Yes, it were better that he should die.
Your Grace. As to the Scottish war, my Lord Protector may go to Scotland, but he will never compass peace without great loss of men or of himself. And he will spend a great sum of money in vain.
As to that, my Lord, I know not, but will leave such matters to my Lord Protector. I pray your Lordship have me remembered to your Queen.
The Protector returned from Scotland in October, and Edward's first Parliament was soon to be summoned. The Admiral had a bill drawn up which would divide the offices of Protector and Governor of the King's person between his brother and himself. He also drafted a letter for Edward to copy and sign, requesting Parliament to favour the matter. But Edward, advised by his tutor, Sir John Cheek, refused to have anything to do with it. If the thing were good, he said, the Lords would allow it. If it were ill, why should I commend it? The bill was not even debated and came to nothing. Relations between the Seymour brothers were not improved by a dispute which had developed between Catherine and the Protector over some property. Another cause of bad feeling was the Protector's wife, the Duchess of Somerset, a woman for many imperfections intolerable, but for pride monstrous, was bitterly jealous of the fact that Catherine, as Queen Dowager, took precedence over her, and made no secret of her feelings on the subject.
Did not King Henry VIII marry Catherine Parr in his doting days, when he had brought himself so low by his lust and cruelty that no lady who stood on her honour would venture on him? And shall I give place to her, who in her former estate was but Latimer's widow, and is now fain to cast herself upon a younger brother? If Master Admiral teach his wife no better manners, I am she that will.
The Admiral expressed himself with equal freedom in a conversation with the Marquis of Dorset.
They speak of a black parliament. If I be thus used, by God's precious soul, I will make this the blackest parliament that ever was in England.
My lord, take heed. If you speak such words, you will lose my Lord Protector utterly and undo yourself.
I would you should know, I may better live without him than he without me. Whoever shall go about to speak evil of the Queen, I will take my fist to his ears, from the highest to the lowest.
My lord, there is no need of these words. I think there is no nobleman that would speak evil of her, for he should then speak evil of the King, who is dead. Wherefore you have no cause to doubt. I trust all should be well, and you and my Lord Protector friends again.
My brother is wondrous hot in helping every man to his right, save me. I would have no Lord Protector in England. I would see the King have the honour of his own things, for he is wise and learned for his years. I cannot now do as I would wish. Yet let me alone, and you shall see I will bring it to pass within these 3 years.
Your lordship knows that I am your friend, and accepting the King's majesty only, I would spend my life and blood in your part against all men.
I would you should make yourself strong in your country, and especially make much of the head yeomen and franklins, for they be men best able to persuade the multitude. Go to their houses and carry with you a flagon or two of wine and a pasty of venison. Use familiarity with them, for so shall you cause them to love you and be assured to have them at your commandment.
The Admiral had already persuaded Lord Dorset to give him custody of his 10-year-old daughter, Lady Jane Grey, promising that he would arrange to marry her to the King. As a further inducement, he lent Dorset £2,000 without security. He hadn't given up his plans for getting Edward away from the Protector, and continued to make every effort to win the boy's affection and trust. Lounging into St. James's Palace one day, he took the opportunity of a conversation with the useful John Fowler.
How does the King's Grace, Master Fowler?
In good health, my lord. Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God.
His Grace desires your lordship to pardon him. For if he could get any spare time, he would write a letter to the Queen and to you. But he is not half a quarter of an hour alone.
Mary, I would have His Grace better ordered and not kept so close that no man may see him. He is liker this way to grow up a fool than otherwise.
His Grace has willed me to tell your lordship that notwithstanding your absence, his mind and love are towards you as much as any man in England. Indeed, he is so much bounden to you that he must needs remember you always.
Oh, I would I had him with me in my house. Indeed, a man might steal him away now, for there came more men with me than are in all the palace.
Well, as to that, my lord, I cannot tell. But I would beg your lordship to take some care when you send me letters to have them delivered into my own hand by some trusty messenger.
You need have no fear. I will remember.
When our friend shall have need of money, I will make bold to send your lordship as you desired. But I trust that my letters shall tell no more tales after your reading.
Surely your trust shall not be misplaced, Master Fowler.
But the Admiral was not a very good conspirator. Tales of his rash behavior had already been carried to the council, and he was summoned to appear before them to give an account of himself. Confident of his power, he refused to go. The Protector was reluctant to take any action against his brother, and tried to get him to mend his ways by gentle persuasion. A reconciliation was patched up between them, but Tom's ambition and jealousy were too strong for it to have any lasting effect. In the spring of 1548, there was a domestic crisis in the household of the Queen Dowager, caused by the Admiral's continued attentions to Princess Elizabeth. Catherine evidently saw how dangerous the situation was becoming, and she lost no further time in putting an end to it. In the week after Whitsun, Elizabeth left her stepmother's protection and went with her own household to live at Cheshunt. From there, she wrote to Catherine.
Although I could not be plentiful in giving thanks for the manifold kindnesses received at your Highness's hand at my departure, yet I am something to be borne withal. For truly I was replete with sorrow to depart from your Highness, especially seeing you doubtful of health. And albeit I answered little, I weighed it deeply when you said you would warn me of all evilnesses that you should hear of me. For if your Grace had not a good opinion of me, you would not have offered friendship to me that way at all. But what may I more say than thank God for providing such friends for me, desiring him to enrich me with their loving life. From Cheshunt this present Saturday, your Highness's humble daughter, Elizabeth.
Catherine was now pregnant for the first time, which must have added to the emotional tension. But she doesn't appear to have blamed the princess for what had taken place, and they continued to correspond affectionately. Elizabeth wrote again on July the 31st.
Your Highness's letter be most joyful to me in absence. Yet considering what pain it is to you to write, your Grace being so great with child and so sickly, your commendation were enough in my lord's letter. I much rejoice with humble thanks that your Grace wished me with you till I were weary of that country. Your Highness were like to be cumbered if I should not depart till I were weary of being with you. Although it were the worst soil in the world, your presence would make it pleasant.
That summer, complaints began to grow about Thomas Seymour's conduct in another quarter. It was part of his duties to suppress the gangs of pirates who preyed on shipping in the English Channel. But it seemed that the Admiral was in a fair way to becoming a pirate himself. According to various angry sea captains and merchants, he was actually encouraging the marauders, and some of their plunder had been seen in his possession. But Tom had bigger things on his mind than piracy. His ultimate ambition was to make himself strong enough to challenge the government openly. For that, he needed money. And it seemed a good moment to renew his acquaintance with Sir William Sharrington, treasurer of the Bristol Mint. Sharrington had been appointed to his office in May 1546, and since then had enriched himself and his friends to the tune of several thousand pounds by various fraudulent practices. The Admiral now promised to protect him from the consequences of his misdeeds if Sharrington would provide him with the funds he needed.
What money could you make me, Sherrington, if need were?
Well, I'm in order about £4,000.
God's soul, that is but a little. Huh. What more could you make me?
Mary, it would be hard for me to make you more at this present, but if you give me a little warning, I would be able to make you as much as I have stuff to make it of.
I would you should get as much stuff as you can into your hands. It is good always to have a mess of money ready, for then a man may do somewhat withal. Let us see now. How much would find 10,000 men for a month?
I would account it about £10,000, my lord.
In faith, Sherrington, if we had £10,000 in ready money, that were well. Could you not make me so much money? I trust we should not lack for it.
You should not, my lord, if I were able to make it. I warrant you should lack no money while the mint stands at Bristol.
Aye, I warrant so.
What would you do with so much money, my lord?
It is always good to have money in readiness if a man should be called to serve the king and to bring such a sort of tenants and servants as I have under my rule. For I reckon I have as great a number of gentlemen that love me as any nobleman in England. In faith, I have more that love me than my Lord Protector has.
Aye, my lord. But I have heard that men speak evil of you for not well using the office of Lord Admiral.
It is my lord, my brother, who says all. None of the council does say anything otherwise than is liking to my lord's grace. I am as glad of my office as of any in the realm. No man shall take it from me, but shall take my life also.
Why, my lord? There be much better offices you may have.
Nay, for I have the rule of a good sort of ships and men. I tell you, Sherrington, it is a good thing to have the rule of men.
At the end of August, Queen Catherine gave birth to a daughter at Sudley Castle. The astrologers had promised that the child would be a boy who the admiral declared would avenge his father's wrongs. In spite of this disappointment, he appeared delighted and wrote enthusiastically to his brother. The protector had been in the middle of another long, reproachful letter urging Tom to mend his ways. But he added a kind postscript.
We are right glad to understand by your letters that the Queen, your bedfellow, hath had a happy hour, and, escaping all danger, hath made you the father of so pretty a daughter. And although it would have been a more joy and comfort if this, the first, had been a son, yet the escape of the danger, and the prophesy of this to a great sort of happy sons, is no small joy to us, as we are sure it is to you, and to her grace also.
But the congratulations were premature. For soon after the birth, Catherine developed a high fever. She became very ill, and a sad little scene took place at her bedside, as reported later by her friend, Elizabeth Tyrwhitt.
My Lady Tyrwhitt, where have you been so long? I do fear such things in me that I'm sure I cannot long live.
Nay, Your Grace, I see no likelihood of death in you.
I am not well handled, for there are those about me that care not for me. Stand laughing at my grief. The more good I will to them, the less good they will to me.
Why, sweetheart, I would do you no hurt.
No, my lord. I think so, for you have given me many shrewd taunts.
Lady Tyrwhitt, what said her grace?
Oh.
She said you had given her many shrewd taunts, my lord.
Poor soul. Oh. She is wandering in her mind. If I should lie down on the bed beside her, could I ease her unquietness?
It may be that you could, my lord.
Hush, sweetheart. You know that I would never do you any unkindness.
My lord, I would have given 1,000 marks to have had my full talk with the physician the first day I was delivered. But I durst not, for fear of displeasing you.
My sweet fool, you need have no fear of me. Oh, what can I say to comfort you?
You will be glad when I am gone, my lord. For then you can have your will. Yes, then you shall have your will.
Catherine died on September the 5th. And at once a rumor spread that she'd been poisoned, but no evidence to support this was ever produced. At first, Tom Seymour appeared genuinely grieved, but all the plans requiring his attention soon helped him to forget. Meanwhile, at Hatfield, where Princess Elizabeth was now living, there was suppressed excitement in the household. Now that the Queen was dead, who could tell what might happen? Catherine Ashley couldn't resist broaching the subject to Elizabeth.
Will not your Grace write to my Lord Admiral to comfort him in his sorrow? He would think it a kindness, for he was your friend in the Queen's time.
No, I will not. He needs no comfort.
If your Grace will not write, then will I.
You may do as you wish, but I will see your letter before it is sent.
As your Grace pleases. It may be that we shall see my Lord at Hatfield before many weeks have passed.
Why should we so?
Your Grace must know that if my Lord had had his own will, he would have married you before the Queen. God rest her soul.
How know you that?
Oh, I know it well enough, both from himself and others. They are saying in London that your Grace shall have the Lord Admiral now, and he will shortly come a-wooing.
You should not listen to gossip, Ashley. That is but a London news.
Well, your Grace shall see, for he would fain have had you before he married the Queen.
Though he may wish to have me, yet I think the council will never consent to it.
But if the council should consent, your Grace would not be unwilling.
If that should come to pass, I will do as God shall put into my mind. Doubtless there is no let on his part but from the council. Yet without their consent, nothing but evil would come of it.
Although marriage to Elizabeth undoubtedly figured largely among the Admiral's schemes, he had no hope of success as matters then stood. King Henry had declared both his daughters, Mary and Elizabeth, illegitimate, and had disinherited them during his lifetime. But both were restored to the succession by the terms of his will. It would, therefore, have been high treason to attempt to marry either of them out of hand. The Admiral knew that he was not yet strong enough to defy the council openly, and he looked round for more support. The Marquis of Dorset was already deeply involved with him, and he now approached the Marquis of Northampton and the Earl of Rutland. He had a conversation with Rutland soon after Catherine's death, as they rode together towards Lord Dorset's house at Bradgate.
My Lord Rutland, you know that I am your friend, and would be glad to do you any service that lay in my power.
I thank you, my lord. I also have ever borne you my goodwill, and shall continue so to do.
I am glad to hear that you will soon be of the Parliament House, but I shall trust to have your voice with me.
Indeed, my lord, I should be content to support you, as my conscience serves me.
I would counsel you to make much of the gentleman in your country, but more of the honest and wealthy yeoman.
My lord?
By making much of them, and sometimes dining like a good fellow in their houses, you may be assured of their goodwill, and so they will follow you wherever you may lead them.
For what purpose, my lord?
Why, that you may be well-friended, and so better able to serve the King's Majesty. I think that in your country, you would be able enough to match the Earl of Shrewsbury.
As to that, my lord, I do not think my Lord of Shrewsbury would do me any wrong. But what of your lordship's own position? Will not your power be much diminished by the Queen's death?
No, by God, the council never feared me so much as they do now. My Lord of Rutland, how say you if a year or two hence, or sooner, should I see occasion, I shall say to the council, the King's Majesty is now of some discretion, and therefore I would that he should have the honor and rule of his own things.
My lord!
For as is now done, the King's Highness beareth the charges, and my brother receiveth the honor. I would not desire any hurt to my lord, my brother. Marry, I would wish him to rule. But as chief counselor only...
It may be that you will succeed in such an enterprise, my lord. But I would counsel you to beware whom you trust.
That I will. No man alive shall accuse me. I doubt not my lord, my brother, would have my head under his girdle, but I trust to do well enough for all that. Shall we ride, my lord?
As time went by, and still the protector made no move to curb his brother, the admiral became more and more self-confident. But gossip about his activities, particularly in regard to Elizabeth, was growing louder. Several people attempted to warn him, notably the venerable Lord Privy Seal, Lord Russell.
My Lord Admiral, there are certain rumours bruited of you which I am very sorry to hear.
Indeed, my lord. I pray you tell me what they may be.
I am informed that you make means to marry either with my Lady Mary or else with my Lady Elizabeth. My lord, if you go about any such thing, you seek the means to undo yourself and all those that shall come of you.
Who has informed you of such a thing, my lord? I would most earnestly desire to know the authors of that tale.
I heard it of divers of your near friends, and such as bear you as much goodwill and wish you as well as I do myself.
Certainly it is untrue. I never thought to make any such enterprise.
I am glad to hear you say so, my lord.
Father Russell, you are very suspicious of me. I pray you tell me who showed you of this marriage that I should attempt.
Nay, my lord, you shall not know the authors. But I most earnestly advise you to make no suit of marriage that way.
It is convenient for the princesses to marry. And it were better they should be married within the realm than in some foreign place. Why should not I, or another, made by the king their father, marry one of them?
My lord, if either you or any other within this realm should match himself in marriage either with my Lady Mary or my Lady Elizabeth, undoubtedly he shall procure the occasion of his utter undoing. And you, above all others, being of so near alliance with the king's majesty, would be undone.
How should that be?
Why, my lord, if you shall also marry with one of the heirs of the crown by succession, his highness may perhaps take occasion to have you in great suspicion, and as often as he shall see you, think that you gape and wish for his death. If such a thought be once rooted in his head, much displeasure may ensue unto you. And I pray you, my lord, what shall you have with either of them?
A man who married one of them should have 3,000 a year.
Nay, my lord, it is not so. You may be well assured that you'll have no more than 10,000 pounds in money, plate, and goods, and no land. And what should that be to maintain his charges in the state, matching himself there?
They must have 3,000 pounds a year also.
By God, but they may not.
By God, none of you dare say nay to it.
By God, for my part, I will say nay to it, for it is clean against the king's will.
Although the admiral was now hardly bothering to conceal his intentions, he seemed unable to believe that any action would be taken against him. He turned his attention to discovering the state of Elizabeth's finances, how many servants she kept, what estate she owned, and where they were situated. He had several conferences with her steward, Thomas Parry, and suggested that some of her lands might be exchanged with others adjoining his own. He was careful to keep on the best of terms with Parry and Mrs. Ashley, and they lost no opportunity of praising him to the princess. But she wouldn't commit herself. When Parry brought her messages from the admiral, offering his advice and help on various matters, she insisted that her governess be told about them. She seemed determined to avoid any suggestion of secret negotiations. On a day early in January 1549, Parry and Catherine Ashley enjoyed a conversation on this fascinating subject.
It seems to me that there is much goodwill between the Lord Admiral and Her Grace. I gather it both from him and Her Grace also.
Oh, yes, it is true. But I have had such a charge in this matter from my Lord Protector and my Lady of Somerset that I durst say nothing of it.
Marry, Her Grace bade me tell you of my Lord Admiral's gentleness and how he had offered her his house in London at such a time that she came to see His Majesty.
Yes, I knew of it. But when I was last with my Lady of Somerset, she found great faults with me for my Lady Elizabeth going one night in a barge on the Thames and other light parts, and said I was not worthy to have the governance of a king's daughter, and another should have my place, for she fears that I bear too much affection for my Lord Admiral. Wherefore I dare not speak of these matters.
I have seen that when by chance the talk is of the Lord Admiral, Her Grace shows a glad countenance, especially when he is well spoken of. Think you he goes about a marriage?
I cannot tell, but I would wish her his wife of all men living. And I warrant he might bring the matter to pass at the council's hands well enough. He is a worthy gentleman. And if the late king's majesty had lived a little longer, she would have been his wife.
But for all that, I have heard much evil report of the Lord Admiral, that he is not only a covetous man and an oppressor, but also a jealous man, and that he used the queen very cruelly and dishonorably.
That is no matter. I know him better than you, or those that so report him. I know that he will make but too much of her grace, and she knows it well enough. The world may speak evil of him, but I would wish her to marry none before him.
I have heard it said that he has kept the Queen's maidens together to wait on my Lady Elizabeth when she is married to
him. It may be so. He loves her but too well, and has done so a good while. The Queen was jealous of her and him. For one time she came suddenly upon them when they were alone, and found the Lord Admiral with my lady in his arms. She sent for me and told me her mind, and there was much displeasure.
Has there indeed been such familiarity between them?
I will tell you more of that another time. But it was not long after that that my lady left the Queen, and that was the reason, as I remember. Though whether her grace departed of her own will or was sent away, I do not know. But I pray you, Master Parry, that you will not in any wise disclose this matter.
I will never do so, mistress. You may trust me.
For if ever these things became known, her grace would be dishonored forever. And I would likewise be undone.
I will never open them to anyone. Truly, I would rather be pulled with horses before I did. You may trust me.
The Admiral now suggested that he should pay a visit to the Princess. Hatfield would be on his way home, he said, when he came from London. This was reported to the Protector, who swore that he would put his brother in the Tower if he attempted to see Elizabeth. About this time, Sherrington's frauds at the Bristol Mint were discovered. Sherrington was arrested and his house searched. In a conversation with Lord Dorset on the 17th of January, Tom Seymour seemed at last to have realized his danger.
The council have had a great secret conference, and as yet I can learn nothing of it. But I know the matter touches me. I think they go about to see if they can get anything from Sherrington against me, and he is straighter handled for my sake.
My lord, I would counsel you to go to my Lord Protector and be plain with him.
Oh, I am able to answer to all things that may be laid to my charge. But I will not go to the council unless I have a pledge that I shall return home again.
But, my lord, knowing yourself to be a true man, why should you doubt to go to your brother? For he is a man of much mercy. And if he lists to have you, it is not this house that can keep you, though you have 10 times so many men as you do.
My lord, my brother is in fear of his own estate and holds me in much jealousy. My lord of Rutland was examined by him very late last night. And I have intelligence that I shall be called to the council to answer such things as are declared against me. But I will answer at my own liberty. By God's precious soul, whosoever lays hands on me, I will thrust my dagger into him.
But that night, when the guard came to arrest him, the admiral offered no resistance. He went, protesting his innocence, and swearing that no poor knave was ever truer to his prince. The council now sent its representative, Sir Robert Tyrwhitt, down to Hatfield to question Elizabeth.
I have to inform your grace that the Lord High Admiral has been committed to the Tower by order of the council on a charge of high treason. I have further to inform your grace that Mistress Ashley and Thomas Parry, the cofferer, have also been arrested.
On what charges, Master Tyrwhitt, had the council ordered the arrest of my governess and my steward?
That they did conspire with the Lord Admiral and aid him in his treasonable intent to marry your grace without the consent of the Lord Protector and the council.
That is not so. Mistress Ashley said always that she would never have me marry without the consent of the King's Majesty, and I would never have agreed to such a thing.
Your grace knows what manner of woman is Mistress Ashley. And when the cofferer was told that my lord, great master, and Master Denny were at the gate, he cried aloud that he was undone, and cast his chain from his neck and his rings from his fingers.
I do not believe that Kate Ashley or Master Parry would ever practice anything to the misliking of the council. Certainly they never told me they would do so.
Come, your grace. If you will but open all things yourself, the evil and shame shall be ascribed to those who should have guarded you better. And your youth will be considered, both with the King's Majesty and the Lord Protector. I would require your grace to consider your honor and the peril that may ensue, for you are but a subject in this realm.
This was a thinly veiled threat to the daughter of Anne Boleyn. But the interview proved a disappointment for Tyrwhitt. In his report to the Protector, he wrote,
"In no wise will she confess any practice by Mistress Ashley or the cofferer concerning my Lord Admiral. I see it in her face that she is guilty. And yet I do perceive that she will abide more storms ere she accuse Mistress Ashley. I assure your grace that she has a very good wit, and nothing is gotten of her but by great policy."
All the same, Elizabeth was in a very dangerous position. Utterly alone and friendless, she was being called on to answer the kind of charge, based chiefly on backstairs gossip, which is always most difficult to refute. She faced continual questioning designed to trap her into admissions which would have ruined her good name and cost her not only her chance of succeeding to the throne, but possibly even her life. And she was still only 15 years old. On the 28th of January, she wrote to the Protector.
"Whereas your lordship has counseled me as an earnest friend to declare what I know in this matter, I shall most willingly do it. Master Parry at one time declared unto me that my Lord Admiral did offer me his house in London for such time as I came to see the King's Majesty, and further asked me, if the council did consent that I should marry the Lord Admiral, whether I would consent or no. I inquired what he meant by asking that question, or who bade him say so. He said nobody bade him say so, but he perceived, as he thought, that my Lord Admiral was given that way rather than otherwise. At another time, Master Parry sent a letter saying that my Lord said he would come this way when he went down into the country. I bade Kate Ashley write as she thought best. So she wrote that she thought it not best for fear of suspicion. And my Lord Admiral, when he heard that, asked Master Parry why he might not come to me as well as to my sister. These be the things I declared unto Master Tyrwhitt, and also whereof my conscience beareth me witness, for I know I have a soul to save as well as other folks have. If there be any more things which I can remember, I will write it myself or cause Master Tyrwhitt to write it. Master Tyrwhitt and others have told me that there go rumours abroad which be greatly against my honour and honesty, which above all other things I esteem. These are that I am in the Tower and with child by the Lord Admiral. My Lord, these are shameful slanders, for the which, besides the great desire I have to see the King's Majesty, I shall most heartily desire your lordship that I may come to court, to show myself there as I am. Written in haste from Hatfield, your assured friend to my little power, Elizabeth."
Tyrwhitt did his best to extract a fuller confession from the princess. He tried a false friend, introducing a lady into the household whom he hoped would gain her confidence. He tried showing her a letter he'd written to the Protector, pretending that he was compromising himself by doing so. Elizabeth thanked him, but she was not deceived, and Tyrwhitt was obliged to write again to his master.
"I have practiced with my lady's grace by all means and policies to cause her to confess more than she has already done. But she does plainly deny that she knows any more than she has already opened to me, which she has written to your grace with her own hand. Yet I do believe that there has been some secret promise between my lady, Mistress Ashley, and the cofferer never to confess until death. And if that be so, it will never be gotten of her but by the King's Majesty, or else by your grace."
But Thomas Parry and Catherine Ashley, interrogated in the Tower, broke down and confessed what they knew concerning the relationship between Elizabeth and the Admiral.
"When I went unto my Lord Admiral, after he had asked me how her grace did and such things, he had large communication with me of her, and questioned with me of many things, of the state of her grace's house, and how many persons she kept. And I told him 120 or 140 or thereabouts. And he asked me what houses she had and what lands. And I told him where the lands lay as near as I could. And he said, as I remember, 'You may get your lands exchanged for better lands, and I would she had her lands westward or in Wales.'"
"At Chelsea,
He would come many mornings to the Lady Elizabeth's chamber before she was ready, and sometimes before she did rise. And if she were up and at her book, he would bid her good morrow and ask her how she did, and strike her upon the back familiarly, and so go forth. And if she were in her bed, he would put open the curtains and bid her good morrow, and make as though he would come at her. And she would go further into the bed so that he could not come at her. And one morning he strove to have kissed her in her bed, but I was there, and bade him go away for shame.
These statements were sent down to Hatfield, and Tyrwhitt took them eagerly to Elizabeth.
Your Grace can see that Mistress Ashley and the cofferer have confessed all. Will you not likewise now confess what you know of this matter?
What have they confessed? How do I know these are not forgeries?
Your Grace knows Mistress Ashley's hand and the cofferer's with half a sight. Mistress Ashley would utter nothing until she and Parry were brought face to face, and he stood fast to what he had written. Thereupon she called him false wretch, and said that he had promised never to confess until death.
Then it was a great matter for him to promise such a promise, and to break it.
The council now wrote to Elizabeth, informing her that Robert Tyrwhitt's wife, who had been Queen Catherine's friend, was to be appointed as her governess in place of Mrs. Ashley. Lady Tyrwhitt got a cold reception from the princess.
Mistress Ashley is my governess, and I have not so demeaned myself that the council should now need to put another mistress over me.
Seeing that your Grace does allow Catherine Ashley to be your mistress, you need not be ashamed to have any honest woman put in her place.
Truly the world will note me to be a great offender that the council should so hastily appoint another governess over me.
If your Grace would think of your honour, you would, considering your years, make suit to the Lord Protector to have a mistress appointed over you, rather than make delay to be without one.
But according to Sir Robert, Elizabeth took the matter so heavily that she wept all night and lowered all the next day. He noted in some exasperation that in his opinion she needed two governesses instead of one. On the 21st of February, Elizabeth wrote again to the Protector, who had offered to punish anyone who slandered her.
You did right that if I would bring forth any that had reported evil of me, the council would see it redressed. This thing, though I can easily do it, would get me the ill will of the people, which I would be loath to have. But if it might seem good to your lordship and the council to send forth a proclamation into the country that they refrain their tongues, declaring how the tales be but lies, it should make the people think that you and the council have great regard that no such rumour should be spread of the King's Majesty's sister as I am, though unworthy.
But in spite of the brave front she was maintaining, the strain was beginning to tell. And Tyrwhitt reported,
she begins a little to droop, by reason she hears that my Lord Admiral's house be dispersed. My wife tells me now that she cannot bear to hear him discommended, but she is ready to make answer therein. And so she has not been accustomed to do, unless Mistress Ashley was touched, when she was ready to make answer vehemently.
Although Elizabeth herself had proved such a disappointing witness, there was no lack of evidence against the Admiral from other sources. Even the king remembered various conversations with his uncle, and the gifts of pocket money, gratefully accepted at the time, were now produced as evidence of treasonable intent. The only person to speak up for Tom Seymour was his faithful friend John Harrington, who had gone with him to the Tower. Examined by the council, Harrington said,
as concerning the order of the government of the king, or any such matter, I never heard the Lord Admiral speak anything privately, but I have once heard him say, before others, that it was never seen in the minority of a king, when there have been two brothers, that one should have all the rule and the other none. Another time I've heard him say that if it were offered unto him to have either the protectorship or the governorship of the king, he would wish the earth to open and swallow him if he would take it. The Lord Admiral might peradventure say to me, this man is my friend. But to say that any man were his assured, or that I might have this or this man assured, or anything tending to the making of a party, I never heard him speak such things in my life.
But 33 articles were drawn up against the Admiral, And on the 23rd of February, a deputation from the council waited on him in the tower to read the charges to him.
Whereas Edward Seymour, Duke of Somerset, was made governor of the king's person, nevertheless you, Thomas Seymour, have gone about and attempted by indirect means to undo this order and get into your hands the government of the king's majesty. Furthermore, by corrupting with gifts and fair promises divers of the Privy Chamber, you, Thomas Seymour, went about to allure his highness to condescend and agree to your most heinous and perilous purposes, to the great danger of the king's person and the subversion of the realm, and that you labored with divers of the nobility of the realm to adhere unto you for the alteration of the state of the realm, and that you promised the marriage of the king's majesty at your will and pleasure. Furthermore, that before you married the late queen, you went about to marry the Lady Elizabeth, and since that time, by secret and crafty means, you have practiced to achieve the said purpose of marrying the said Lady Elizabeth. That having knowledge that Sir William Sherrington had wonderfully defrauded and deceived the king's majesty, nevertheless, you, by all means you could, did aid and assist him, contrary to your allegiance and duty. And that where divers merchants have had their goods piratously robbed and taken, you have had the goods in your hands and daily seen in your house, without any restitution to the parties so injured and spoiled. And that divers of the head pirates being brought unto you, you have let the same pirates go again, free unto the sea.
The admiral refused to make any answer except in open trial, and the question now arose whether he should be tried or whether Parliament should have the ordering of the matter. In other words, should an act of attainder be brought against him? One by one, the members of the council cast their votes in favour of an attainder. Finally, the Protector himself was called upon to speak.
Although this case is greatly sorrowful unto me, yet I do rather regard my bounded duty to the King's Majesty and the Crown of England than I do to my own son or brother, and do weigh more my allegiance than my blood. Therefore, I cannot resist, nor will not be against your lordship's request, but as his majesty wishes, I will most obediently be content.
Edward was present at the meeting, and after the Protector had spoken, he was asked for his consent.
We do perceive that there are great things which be objected and laid to my Lord Admiral, mine uncle, and that they tend to treason. We perceive that you require but justice to be done. We think it reasonable, and our will is that you proceed according to your request.
Tom Seymour was given a last chance to make some defense. When he realized that he was not to have a trial, he reluctantly agreed to answer the charges. With regard to the king, he said,
upon occasion of talk of the King's Majesty's subordinates with my Lord of Rutland, I said that His Highness would be a man 3 years before any child living, and that I thought within 2 or 3 years he would desire more liberty and the honor of his own things. As I desire to be saved, I cannot name any other with whom I had conference in this matter, but I do remember that I have wished the king were at home at my house. But when that was, or to whom I did say it, I do not remember. I did never determine in all my life to remove the king out of my Lord Protector's hands, but by the consent of the whole realm. Moreover, I said that I would my lord, my brother, should be the chief director of his majesty's affairs in the council. And if I meant any hurt to my lord, my brother's grace, more than I meant to my own soul, then I desire neither life nor favor at his hands.
The admiral admitted having given money to John Fowler. He also admitted that he tried to persuade Edward to write to Parliament in favor of a change in his guardianship. But beyond that, he refused to go. He had confessed enough, he said. On the 25th of February, the Bill of Attainder was framed and brought before the House of Lords. It was passed at its third reading, though the Protector asked for leave of absence for natural pity's sake. It was much debated in the Commons, but finally passed on the 4th of March. It now rested with the Protector whether or not to grant a pardon to his brother. On March the 10th, the Council asked the King for permission to take the final decision without further troubling or molesting my Lord Protector. A week later, the Admiral was told to prepare himself for his execution, which was to take place on March the 20th. He spent his last night writing to the Princesses Mary and Elizabeth, urging them to conspire against the Protector. These letters were laboriously written with an improvised pen made from the egglet of a point which he had plucked from his hose, and ink so craftily made as the like has never been seen. He entrusted them to one of his servants, who concealed them in the sole of a shoe. But as he mounted the scaffold, his muttered reminder to the man was overheard. The letters were discovered and destroyed. When they brought the news to Elizabeth, still in virtual imprisonment and disgrace at Hatfield, she made one comment only.
This day has died a man of much wit, but little judgment.
William Sherrington was pardoned, Parry and Mrs. Ashley were presently released, and Elizabeth took them both back into her service. She had got her proclamation from the Protector, but the smear remained, and it took her some years of almost nun-like retirement to live it down. No one ever knew what she really felt about the handsome, blundering, boastful creature who had schemed so shamelessly to use her for his own advancement. But she was ill for several months after his execution. The episode marked the end of childhood for Elizabeth and turned her into the pale-faced, tight-lipped young woman who must weigh every word and never forget the terrible dangers that lay in wait for those who betrayed their true feelings. Years later, when she was Queen of England, the Admiral's old friend, John Harrington, presented her with a portrait of his dead master. Elizabeth had always shown her favour to Harrington, and she accepted the gift. Perhaps the romantic sonnet attached to the portrait described Tom Seymour as she wanted to remember him.
Of person rare, strong limbs and manly shape, by nature framed to serve on sea or land, in friendship firm, in good state or ill hap, in peace headwise, in war skill great bold hand, on horse or foot, in peril or in play, none could excel, though many did essay. A subject true to king, a servant great, friend to God's truth, and foe to Rome's deceit. Sumptuous abroad for honour of the land, temperate at home, yet kept great state with stay, and noble house that fed more mouths with meat than some advanced on higher steps to stand. Yet against nature, reason and just laws, his blood was spilt, guiltless, without just cause.
That was Elizabeth's Admiral. It was compiled from contemporary documents by Alison Plowden and produced by Joe Burrows. It was narrated by Richard Herndl. Thomas Seymour was played by Hayden Jones, the Princess Elizabeth by Susan Maudsley, Catherine Ashley by Marjorie Westbury, with Jean England as Edward VI, John Pullen as William Paget, and David March as Robert Tyrwhitt. Other parts were played by Elizabeth Villiers, Basil Jones, John Justin, Victor Lucas, Anthony Jackson, Roland Herdman, Frank Henderson, Betty Hardy, Alan Dudley, Carol Marsh, and Ralph Truman.